end of GRPC 27. I'm Peggy Tartaro, executive editor of Women and Guns magazine and a board member of the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. I'd like to welcome you once again on behalf of everybody. A couple quick announcements before we get started, and then we'll get right into our panels. There is no formal break during this session, so if you need to go out of the room for a beverage or a bathroom or to work on your bags or something, please do it from the rear and quietly. Our bookstore will be open for about a half hour after our last panel, which is the resolutions panel. They are open now, so many of our speakers yesterday and several of our speakers today have books out there. I'm sure they'd appreciate it if you supported them that way. There may be some extra material at the end of the session, extra stacks of books. You can check with Jennifer and Lori at the registration table for those if you've got a good use for them, somebody, a club member or someone who can use them, take them along. It's cheaper for us to disseminate the information than to pack it up and ship it back. Parking validation. You need a separate parking validation for every day. So if you don't have a parking validation for today, go and get one. Again, from Lori and Jennifer and out at registration. Registration will be closed in a few minutes, but they will be there till the bitter end. I think that's all our formal announcements. So we're going to start a couple of minutes early with our first panel, and that way the time will be all an easy-peasy kind of thing. Our first panel this morning is called Growing the Gun Culture Base in the Popular Culture War. And we're lucky to have two speakers. One of them has already done a flit, but three speakers in addition to me. The reason I get to talk is this panel was my idea. Julie Gottlieb, who moderated yesterday, participated in one of her panels because she's an expert on the UN and the world gun rights movement. I'm here because I wanted to be Emma Peel when I grew up. And my first dog, named in conjunction with my older brother and younger sister, was called Moochie in honor of a minor character on the Mickey Mouse Club. It's fitting that our first in 27 years pop culture panel is in Orlando, a town built on popular culture. You don't have to take more than one step off an airplane before you're assaulted with popular culture images. And that's what we want to talk about. Popular culture matters, and that's why I wanted this panel. Our speakers are on the front line of it. Rich manages a rock band, Madison Rising, who you've all had an opportunity to enjoy this weekend. Neil's screenplays, novels, films. Alan, what the? oh, yeah, he's agent provocateur who knows the value of pop culture in talking with others. Pop culture is shared language. You don't have to like it or even pay for it to keep up with it. A speaker yesterday, in fact, our very first speaker, Tony Winfield, referenced a 40-year-old Twilight Zone episode, and everybody in this room got it. That's why when you talk to other groups of people, before you even get to the good stuff, popular culture is a shared language and a way of talking with them. When Tony talked about that episode titled To Serve Man, light bulbs went off in the room and everybody pretty much said, oh yeah, that was a cookbook. It's a shared kind of the image, everybody knows what it means. Everybody knows where he's going with his remarks. And there's millions, literally, of similar ways for us to connect. If you're lucky enough to be asked to talk to the PTA or to, you know, you're sitting around the lunch break table with your coworkers, yes, we do want you to talk about guns. We do want you to invite folks to the range. But sometimes it's a lot easier to start with some of these shared images. Between us gun nuts and the extreme left, if you had a Venn diagram, there'd probably be that little shared section, and it would be called doesn't watch television. This is a room where when you're talking to people, they say, well, I don't watch television. I don't have cable. It's all crap. And yeah, you're right. But you ignore it at your own peril. It is important. It does. I'm always telling my dad, you don't actually have to watch this stuff to know what it's about. Yesterday, Maria Heil asked all the women in the room to raise their hand. I'd like them to do that again today. Ladies? Oh, okay, then stand up. Maria said you have to stand up. She's going to be really embarrassed when I say the rest of this. Okay, ladies, how many of you have read 50 Shades of Grey? But everybody in the room knows what that is. And that's exactly my point. You don't have to read the latest titillating novel out there, but you do have to know what it's about. Because when you're, you know, ladies are sitting around after, you know, while you're waiting for the kids to be done with the swim meet, that's going to be the first topic of conversation, not the UN treaty. So it behooves you to at least be able to speak the same language as your other people. Popular culture has a way of seeping all the way down, even in the firearms industry, in the sporting goods business. Anybody want to guess what the two hottest selling categories are these days? Zombies is one, and archery is the other. Archery is popular. It was a surprise hit. At least it was a surprise to NBC that it was a big hit on the Olympics this year, that it got, even though it was mostly relegated to, you know, the higher cable channels of the NBC empire, it got really good ratings. The executives there compared it to the popularity of curling in the Winter Olympics. The reason archery was captured people's imaginations, and especially captured the imagination of young audiences, was because of the Hunger Games, the movies, and the book series. Again, these are jumping off points. You want to get a 14-year-old kid who's looking at you with the side eyes, interested in going to the range? Well, you know, you might want to say the words Katniss Everdeen. These are ways of talking to groups that we don't normally get to talk to. The interesting thing about the whole zombie deal with the targets and the cartridges and so on is it's also, there's been a couple of big quote-unquote zombie shoots. Like cowboy action shooting, which again took itself from popular culture, from the old cowboy westerns, and so on. The zombie shoots are the same deal. And they're attracting a much younger, much more diverse group of people, because you've got everybody who's watching The Walking Dead rather than, you know, everybody who grew up with John Wayne. That's a, you know, 50-year difference in the demographic, and it's an important one. So as you listen to our next three speakers, I want you to keep that in mind. I want you to keep in mind ways in which you can frame discussions with other people, sneak up on them, talk to them about books and movies and television before you go into it. The dark side of popular culture is, a lot of it's ugly, a lot of it's corrosive. We don't have to look any further than the Batman shooting in Aurora to see that. But right away, the media jumped on it and said, oh, do you think it was because it was the movie? And, you know, they scratched their head, and they say, oh, no, it wasn't because it was the movie. Well, it's up to us to say, you know, we enjoy movies too, but sometimes we have to look at them in different ways. And if, I'm not suggesting that they be censored, but I am suggesting that we turn the argument back on them. The media, the best way to get the media's attention, like almost any other groups, is to talk about the media. People love to talk about themselves. And so, again, that's, you know, a good talking point, a good jumping off point. With that in mind, I would crave your attention for the rest of our panel, and we're going to start it off with Rich.
Hi, I'm Rich Megradichian. I'm the creator and manager of Madison Rising. You probably heard the guys play the other night. We played both Friday and Saturday night. Here's the album cover. You saw it for sale outside. Maybe a lot of you bought it or got copies of it. But hopefully you enjoyed the show. So let me tell you a little bit about us and why Joe decided to have us here today. We're a little bit different than other bands. We're what we call a pro-American rock band, which basically means all of our music, and I mean all of it, every single song that we have is pro-American, pro-soldier, pro-military, pro-constitution, and pro-gun. So, in fact, one of the songs we played both nights is a song called Right to Bear. It's actually the opening track on our album, one of the most popular songs out there. And we wrote that song with the intent of trying to make it an anthem for the gun industry, because God knows there's enough anthems and enough sound bites and enough noise on the other side that it's good for us to be able to counter with something. And we're hoping the song Right to Bear can do that in the gun industry, and our other songs can do that in the other sections of the pro-American market. So we created the band with two goals in mind. The first one was to fill a void in the music market, which is notoriously liberal and notoriously anti-American and anti-gun. The second reason was to use pop culture, in this case, great rock music, to get messages out to people on a much broader scale than any other medium out there. So why pop culture? So like Peggy said, pop culture, the answer is simple. Pop culture is the single best form of communication out there. It's infinitely viral. It permeates every element of what we do, what we think, what we say. And ultimately, pop culture is what defines us as Americans and as people. It's energizing. It reaches people at an emotional level, which is what we need. God knows we have more than enough intellectual arguments, white papers, flowcharts, and so forth. So to be able to reach people at an emotional level is incredibly valuable, and that's what pop culture does. It's also easy to leverage. With a book, you're lucky if you could get somebody to read it at all, even read the back or a single chapter. With music, you take this album and you could listen to it 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times. We all have music we've listened to, Led Zeppelin, The Rolling Stones, The Who, Joe Walsh, whatever it is. We've heard each one of those songs 1,000 times, and we still listen to it again. That's the power of pop culture. And while we're listening to it, there's a good chance someone else will listen to it as well. which is really the key. The fact that other people will hear it too and start absorbing the concepts and the wisdom and the energy that's contained within these songs or within a movie or within whatever the medium is. One of the biggest problems with other forms of communication, like conferences, unfortunately, is that the message rarely ever leaves the room. We're preaching to the choir. We understand what we're trying to say. We get what we're trying to say. But then we have to go out and force it on everybody else. With pop culture, it's different. With pop culture, it's subtle. It's in the background. It slowly permeates the way people think. And that's a much more effective way of getting people to do what you want them to do or think the way you want them to do than force something down your throat. In fact, it's probably at least 1,000 times more effective than any other form of communication just because it is so viral and is so easy to diffuse through society. Video games are a good example. You're all familiar with video games out there, Call of Duty and so forth, and those are all elements of pop culture. They're teaching kids about guns, and then the kids go out and they really learn about guns, about military, about battles and all these things. It's just one small element that's an example of what we're talking about in general. But in terms of Madison Rising itself, our rock rendition of the national anthem, a song which has been around for 200 years and sort of the only time people ever play it or listen to it is before a baseball game or before a boxing match, it's sort of been dying on the vine. We did a rock rendition of that to revive it, bring it into the 21st century, and re-energize it for everybody. And that rock rendition is now number one on Amazon.com. We also offered up a challenge to get people to buy that rock rendition of the national anthem, put it on their iPods, play it in their cars, play it at the beach, play it at the gym, tell all their friends about it. And every day we get literally hundreds of messages from people who are telling us they're doing just that. So through pop culture and through a remake of a 200-year-old song, everybody is now dancing to that song, rocking out to that song, whether they're 75 years old, 15 years old. Parents are emailing us. They're telling us, hey, our kids are playing the national anthem. When I walk in their room to clean, you know, to tell them to clean their room, they're sitting there listening to the national anthem. That has never happened before. That's the power of pop culture. So it's along those lines, we need to remember it's a great mechanism for attracting the younger demographic, which ultimately is what we really need, especially in terms of the gun lobby. We need those votes. I mean, Joe is almost 80 years old, and he really understands the power of what we're doing and why it's so important. Hopefully more people in the gun industry and the gun lobby in particular will understand the power of pop culture and how we could leverage that to get the messages out there and protect our Second Amendment rights, because at the end of the day, it might be the only thing that could save them.
Thank you very much, Rich. And now I'm going to bring up Neil Shulman.
Good morning. It's been a number of years since I've been to one of these conferences. So I'm going to take a moment to remind you guys who the heck I am. In the stack of books that have been given out is this one, Stopping Power, Why 70 Million Americans Own Guns. I wrote this book. The Second Amendment Foundation sold a lot of them. The NRA sold a lot of them. And if you look at the cover, there's a quote from Charlton Heston about it. Mr. Shulman's book is the most cogent explanation of the gun issue I have yet read. He presents the assault on the Second Amendment in frighteningly clear terms. Even the extremists who would ban firearms will learn from his lucid prose, Charlton Heston. It also says on the cover, winner of the James Madison Award. I wrote some op-eds for the Los Angeles Times, and the fourth one at one of these previous gun rights policy conferences, I was given the James Madison Award for writing one of them. I've been a hardcore gun activist since the 1980s. How many of you remember a grammatical analysis of the Second Amendment? Oh, well, not quite. It was this. A well-schooled electorate being necessary to the education of a free state, the right of the people to keep and read books shall not be infringed. That was my interview with Roy Coprud. You've probably seen that a lot on the web. I did the first interview in the Orange County Register with Gary Kleck, which established 2.5 million gun defenses every year. Even before Gary came out with his formal report, because of my article that was quoted in congressional testimony before the House Subcommittee on Crime, by both sides, because I was the only source. So I was president of my, when I lived in Los Angeles, of the West Side NRA Members Council. I was president of that. Did a lot of media. I debated Sheriff Sherman Block on television on assault rifles. Did a lot of, writing, wrote on medical malpractice, the CDC, classifying bullets as pathogens. I wrote about that for National Review. A talk I gave at a temple in Santa Monica got called by the Village Voice, a tough Jew manifesto, when I basically told these Santa Monica Jews why Jews need to have guns. So I've been, basically, at the front line fighting this fight for many, many years. But outside of that, I've been a professional in the media. I have written 3 novels. My first novel, which I'm going to be talking more about in a moment, Alongside Night, I started writing when I was 21 years old. I finished the first draft of it when I was 23 years old. It was published when I was 26 years old. So I was a young guy when I wrote my first novel, and it had endorsements on it from Nobel laureate Milton Friedman, Anthony Burgess, who wrote A Clockwork Orange, and more recently, Glenn Beck raved about it on his radio show, and Dr. Ron Paul endorsed it. And I'll tell you why that's important in a moment. I wrote for The Twilight Zone. You heard about the Rod Serling Twilight Zone, To Serve Man. I wrote one when CBS brought The Twilight Zone back in the 1980s. I wrote the one about the time traveler who goes back to 1963 and stops the JFK assassination. Maybe some of you have seen that. So, I have been in pop culture. Now, let me ask a question. Anybody here under age 30, please raise your hands. Any of you under age 25, raise your hands. Okay? We've got a little bit of an age gap here that we need to close. The thing about Alongside Night, when I wrote it when I was in my 20s, is that I made the characters 17, 18 years old. And now, having made a previous feature film, which Dave Hardy calls, a great pro-Second Amendment movie, it was called Lady Magdalene's, and it's something that Peggy should note, because it was about women and guns. The Lady Magdalene's is about a woman with a gun who basically, this was before, he was actually killed, who basically captures the director of Al-Qaeda. Okay? It's a suspense comedy. And it won 3 film festival awards, including one for a prize for libertarian values at the Freedom Fest, Anthem Film Festival, 2 other film festival awards, Audience Choice, and various other things. It's been shown on TV, and now it's had about 35,000 downloads from the web. So this pro-Second Amendment movie is getting some penetration of the message and injects into popular culture. But now I'm making my second movie, and it's based on my 1979 novel, Alongside Night. And the reason why I'm bringing this up to you right now is that I'm going to pitch you for money. We've raised $200,000. I'd like to raise another $100,000, $200,000 to be able to bring it into full theatrical quality. We're starring Kevin Sorbo. How many of you know Kevin Sorbo? Hercules, The Legendary Journeys. Okay. On Monday, October 8th, we're holding auditions in Los Angeles, and we are going to cast the 4 young actors who are going to be playing the 17, 18-year-old leads of the movie. Because what Alongside Night is going to be is a pure pro-liberty, pro-Second Amendment, relevant, not put off in some distant future, not put on another planet, not put into some weird timeline where people are shooting bows and arrows. It's going to be 5 years from now in Las Vegas, in which my 17-year-old hero is given a Glock by his father right at the beginning of the movie, which he tucks in his belt before he goes out to do a mission for his dad. And when he comes home again, his entire family is missing. And so much of the rest of the movie, he's searching for his dad, and that motivates a lot of the plot. Alongside Night, which I wrote in the 1970s.
2 minutes.
2 minutes? Okay. I can finish in 2 minutes. Alongside Night is about the economic collapse of the dollar due to the government overspending. It was called science fiction when I wrote it in the 1970s. Does anybody here today consider this science fiction? I will get through to the next generation. I will get through to them. I have a brochure here in which I explain the terms. It's not a straight film investment. It's basically a bundling of product placement, merchandising, advertising services, which just happens to give you a 100% single line item tax deduction under IRS Section 181, which Congress passed to promote domestic film production. So in other words, any money you put into this, you get to write off on your taxes as a single item expense. In essence, it's like getting a charitable deduction, only you're getting all these advertising and promotion services in addition to an equity position in the movie itself. I think that's a pretty good deal. And when you're talking about a movie, which is going to be the action adventure to get this through, I am standing here telling you I am the opposite of Aaron Sorkin. Aaron Sorkin is the guy who gave you The American President and The West Wing and keeps on putting anti-gun messages in everything he does. I'm the answer to Aaron Sorkin. Maybe you don't watch movies because you're sick and tired of all the left-wing anti-American messages. I'm the other side, and I ask for your support. Thank you. Please take a brochure. Anybody want to start passing these around? Somebody want to start passing these around? I've got around 90 of them here. I don't know if that's enough for the room. But if you need more, tell me.
Thanks, Neil. And now we'll let Mr. Corwin clean it up. Thank you.
Clean it up. Richard's going to have to leave, and I have something for him. He's in a real band. I'm in kind of a band called the Cartridge Family. We do political parody, and I'm going to give him all our repertoire if he wants it. We do a song called Wake Up Little Uzi. And it's yours if you want it. We do the little armed lady from Pasadena. She always smells a little like that Hoppy's cleaner. She's going to bag a bad guy sooner or later with her 9mm Glock with the compensator. And, of course, you can have Miguel row your coke ashore.
Okay.
So if you want those songs, they're yours. I know he has to leave, so I gave them to him first.
Thanks.
Good luck with Madison Rising.
We'll play them next year when we're back here.
You got it. I'll send you the lyrics. I have your band's. Oh, thanks very much. Before I start, I discovered a problem with the gun safety rules, and I have this many gun guys in the audience. I want to run this by you. The first gun safety rule, basically treat every gun as if it's loaded, right? Second gun safety rule is always point a gun in a safe direction. Don't let the muzzle cover anything you're not willing to destroy. I'd like to suggest that that safety rule is flawed. Where would you point a gun in a room like this? There is no safe place. In an urban environment, which is where we almost always are, there is no safe place to point a gun. No safe place. The ground? This is concrete. Up? There is no safe place. I suggest that that rule needs a little improvement. I want you to think about that. I'll be here till noon today. I think the only safe place for a gun, the second rule, needs a little rework. The second rule ought to be this. A gun should always remain holstered until ready to use. Now, that's only for a handgun. Long guns present a different problem. And I just thought this up, and I'm breaking this news or this idea here at GRPC. I want you to think about that. I'll be here till noon. Talk to me about it. The second rule has a little bit of a flaw. There is no safe way to point a gun. Think about that. Okay, let me get started. Is anybody in here pro-gun? I can't hear you. Is anybody in here pro-gun? I still can't hear you. Is anybody pro-gun? I think that's a bad idea, too. And here's why. And this is all pop culture. And you want to change hearts and minds. The people who hate guns, and that's maybe a third of the population, although the media makes it look like it's the majority. The people who hate guns think guns are bad and evil and the devil's work. They hate guns. They think the correct position is to be anti-gun. If you're pro-gun, then you're the devil. You're doing the devil's work. Guns are bad. You should be anti-gun. If you say you're pro-gun, you lose that argument from the get-go. You're pro-gun, that's bad. I think you're pro-rights. You're pro-rights. What does that make them? Anti-rights. Who wins that argument from the start? You're pro-rights. They're anti-rights. They're anti-self-defense. They're anti-freedom. Who wins that argument? You do. My suggestion is you change your language. Sorry. There are a stack of these outside, the gunlaws.com catalog. In the back of this is a politically corrected glossary with words you should be using. You should never say pro-gun. When somebody says to you, are you pro-gun? Meaning, are you one of those evil people? You look them in the eye and you say, well, I'm pro-rights. How about you? All of a sudden, they are stuck. And you win that argument. Pro-choice? The same thing, pro-choice, pro-life. They do this to us all the time. Here's another one. Do you have an assault weapon? Now, you guys are bright enough to figure this out, even though they want you to think you're a bunch of dumb, knuckle-dragging gun bubbas. Assault is a kind of behavior. It is not a kind of hardware. Assault weapon? When they say, Alan, do you own any assault weapons? Well, I have some household firearms. The same kind of firearms you'd find in any American household. Of course, in our case, some of them are belt-fed and water-cooled. And you win that argument, too. They want to know if you have a handgun. They have vilified the word handgun, which they always call a semi-automatic handgun, because a lot of them think that means machine gun. You should never say handgun. I never say handgun anymore. I say sidearm. Sidearm is neutral and has no bad connotation, and I have a sidearm. Now, I know your permits say concealed, and you like to talk about concealed, but concealed sounds like you're hiding something. A criminal conceals something. You have something to hide. I'd like to suggest you carry discreetly. Discreet carry is the civilized norm. Discreet carry. We have so many words in this politically corrected glossary in the back of this. And you can go to gunlaws.com and read the entire politically corrected glossary, and you will change your language, and things will change. You will start winning your debates. You'll start talking about carrying a sidearm discreetly, and you will start winning those debates. Now, Peggy made a classic mistake, and I've heard everybody here talking about being pro-gun this and pro-gun that instead of being pro-rights this and pro-rights that, and we would change the debate right there. She talked about the Batman movie massacre. The Batman movie massacre. The guy dressed like the Joker. They miss the irony. They refuse to do this, and the media won't change, but we can. They miss the irony. These people were sitting there waiting to watch a blood-drenched massacre and got to witness a blood-drenched massacre. We're training our kids to be assassins. And then they become assassins and we scratch our heads. It is not a mystery. Let me tell you, when I grew up, you could buy a gun in a comic book and have it delivered by mail. Guns were more accessible when all us over 25-year-olds were kids. You could buy a gun through the mail. There was no FBI. There was no paperwork. There were no state line limits. There were no age limits. You bought guns through comic books, in the grocery store, in the hardware store. Guns were more available, easier, when we were kids and we didn't have massacres. What changed? The movies, the video games, the popular culture. Kids brought guns to school. You got educated about guns. The principal, the teachers, we all knew about guns. Half the homes in America had guns, still have guns. Now a kid graduates from school, he doesn't know what kind of gun to buy. He doesn't know what guns are. He only knows the blood-drenched massacres in the movies and the video games, and now we're having massacres, and they don't know what happened. They want you to think that it only happens here. They have as many public shootings in Europe, as John Lott pointed out yesterday, as we have here, but they don't tell you this. So you get a distorted view of what's going on. And it's because of the media. The media is the missing link, and they're hiding it from you. They are hiding it from you. It's the Batman movie massacre anytime you discuss it. Do not besmirch an American city by calling that massacre by the name of the city. It's the Batman movie massacre. That is what is going on. You change that, and you'll change the world. Now, you want to bring this out into the public view? How many of you have a doctor? Let me see a show of hands. It's not a trick question. You can raise your hands. Ask your doctor about hoplophobia. How many of you heard the word hoplophobia? Oh, good. The public doesn't know it. If you mention hoplophobia to the media, they love new words. Hoplophobia? That is a morbid fear of guns, and they all have it. The DSM, the Directory of Medical Conditions, is being rewritten now. It's expected out in May of 2013. They are refusing to include hoplophobia, but they are putting in shift work disorder. Shift work disorder. And they're fighting over, oh, what do they call it? Oh, I can't remember the name. It's when you fight with your parents. Your parents want one thing and you don't want to agree. They want to call that a mental disorder. They're putting in every bogus, politically correct disorder you can imagine. But hoplophobia, we fight as a political problem, a medical condition. People are afraid of guns, and they turn it into political action. These people need sympathy and medical treatment. Sympathy and medical treatment. And you can fight this the next time you see your frickin' dentist. Women, stand up again. When you see your gynecologist, you ask, what do you think about hoplophobia? And your doctor's going to say, what's that? You're going to say, morbid fear of guns. And your doctor's going to get pale. While you're in the stirrups. You ask about hoplophobia. And you say morbid fear of guns, and your doctor won't be able to stop thinking that, and will start talking about that at the cocktail parties. My patient, while she was in the stirrups, asked me about hoplophobia. I don't do a woman's voice very good. What can I tell you? What was that? Let me hear that. She said 2 minutes. That isn't what you laughed at.
You're
what was
expert.
The remark?
You're an expert.
Oh, well, I used to be. This needs to be brought out. We are fighting. There's a handful of doctors working with me to get hoplophobia recognized. Dr. Bruce Eimer, he's a board-certified psychiatrist and an NRA firearms instructor and a police firearms instructor. All the doctors working on the DSM are hoplophobic, terrified of guns. They are refusing to put this condition in the book. Because they know they are. Half the nation is. We are fighting a medical condition that morphs into a political battle. You got to confront it. When you see this, you got to say, oh, you seem like you're hoplophobic. What's that? Morbid fear of guns. I'm not hoplophobic. The first sign of the disease is denial. They all do it. Now, there's another place you can bring this up, and that's in your church or synagogue. A lot of people cling to their guns and Bibles. They get it. A lot of people don't. The Jewish community, as Neil pointed out, the Jews lead the gun control battle. The biggest gun controllers in Congress are all Jewish. Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Charles Schumer, Carl Levin, Bloomberg in New York. He's not in Congress, but he's one of the leaders. It's amazing. You would think of all the people who would get it, the Jews would get it. The Jews are the most hoplophobic. They lead the gun control battle. Go to your church, go to your synagogue, and ask, why are you so against guns? Now, the politically corrected glossary at gunlaws.com has some of the questions you should ask. There are answers to these things, and you folks don't know them now, but you need to learn them. The only purpose of a gun is to kill. Well, killing is illegal. The only purpose of a gun is to protect. And all of a sudden, there are deer in the headlights. They don't know how to answer that. They should take all the guns away. Who is they? They don't have an answer.
Hitler,
that doesn't really work because that's too strident. They don't see Hitler. They should take all the guns away. So you mean like the government should take all the guns away? Yeah. Well, most of these people are Obama supporters. So you play their side. You say, well, I could understand taking all the guns away if Obama's in power. But what if Bush is in power? You want to give all the guns to Bush? And they freak out because they don't like Bush. They don't trust Bush. Give all the guns to Bush. Well, maybe that's not such a good idea. So you want to give all the, if guns are terrible, I don't like guns. So why do we give them to the police? And all of a sudden, cognitive dissonance strikes. They get a splinter in there. They can't reconcile these things. You can get them to think. You can get them to question these problems. I want you to do it. And one other thing before I leave, because I see I'm getting the hook. I come from the great state of Arizona, where we don't need no stinking permit. And you can get that too, because it's not a law, it's a repeal of a law. And we need more repeals. Go for repeals, and thank you very much, GRPC.
Thanks, Alan. And just to bring it all back home, we don't need no stinking licenses. That's Alfonso Bedoya and treasurer of the Sierra Madres.
Right.
So, pop culture in action.
He did not use the double negative. I've watched it closely. He says, we don't need any stinking.
We don't.
That's a better line with a double negative.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to bring up my next panel, Dave Koppel, and